It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickards.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll look at how one Wisconsin company has spawned a whole new industry of consulting firms, leading to pretty good paying jobs into the six figures.
First, as the battle over a proposed iron ore mine in northern Wisconsin continues, a new wrinkle has been thrown into the mix. The Department of Natural Resources has confirmed that asbestos fibers have been found in a rock sample at the proposed mining site.
While opponents have latched onto this finding as another reason to reject the mine, the DNR says the extent to which the asbestos-like fibers are present is not yet known, and if Gogebic Taconite goes through with a formal mining application, more research will need to be done.
Joining us now to talk about that story is Mike Simonson, WPR's reporter in Superior. Mike, as always, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about how these asbestos fibers were found?
It's in the ore body of the Gogebic Range. It hasn't been known until this past week that it was actually in the proposed mine site. Grunerite is what holds the asbestos fibers, and grunerite's found in the UP, where there are also iron ore mines, in the Iron Range of Minnesota. But this was something that the DNR has asked GTAC to look into, and whether or not GTAC has found it or not, I don't know yet, and they're not saying. But an independent geologist with Northland College, which is also the home of the Sigurd Olson Environmental Institute, went on a hike with a few other people on Saturday to the bulk mining site of U.S. Steel, which did a lot of bulk sampling, rock sampling in 1960. And there's a bunch of boulders and rocks left over from that sampling. And so they simply chipped away at that, took some pictures, and they found... they're not even calling it asbestos-like fibers. They're calling it asbestos fibers. The DNR calls them asbestos form fibers, and I'm not clear on the difference there, except maybe asbestos form just means that it's the shape of asbestos versus being actual asbestos.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so we know with asbestos, when it's in, say, you know, a house in flooring, that it's generally not a problem unless you get in there and cause a disturbance so that they get loosed into the air. What do we know about how asbestos functions at a mining site like this?
Well, there, like you just mentioned, the big danger is if you disturb it, it gets in the air. And the Tom Fitz, who is the Northland College geoscience professor who found it, said the concentration is 60% of the rock that he sampled at that site, which is way more than what he found. And he's looked at the UP and he's looked at the Iron Range of Minnesota. He said it didn't surprise him that it was found in this deposit, but the thickness of it. So he says that if there's blasting that could happen there just for rock sampling, which they haven't, GTAC doesn't have permission yet for, but that's what they want permission to do. Even bulk sampling, mini mining, would put this stuff in the air and be dangerous for workers and could be transferred, you know, into the air, and where whichever way the wind's blowing, Mellon or Anderson or whatever direction, could be bad for that area too.
So is the idea that it would spread beyond the people who are working on the mining site and maybe waft through the air, getting into some of the nearby communities and towns?
Yeah, that's the concern. The DNR is being much more, you know, because this is such a startling revelation that was released over the weekend. They're you know, just let's wait and see. Let's see what else we can find. But that is the concern, if it'll go in the air. But also, there's a history of asbestos being a problem in the water. Back in 1972, the reserve mining case of Silver Bay, which is on Lake Superior, an ore processing plant put taconite tailings with asbestos-like fibers into Lake Superior. And the whole communities of Silver Bay to Duluth had to start drinking bottled water for I don't know how long. But it was a tremendous scare.
Now, as you know, mining has been an incredibly hot-button issue in Wisconsin recently. This may come as news to you, Mike. Yeah, it's a hot-button issue. So how is this changing the way the debate is being shaped so far?
Well, that's still, and I hate this saying, that remains to be seen. But this is going to be a big issue, even as soon as Thursday. The Ashland County Board, and this sampling site was found in the lone sampling site in Ashland County. There are eight other sites, but they're all in Iron County. The Ashland County Board is so concerned about this that they have asked Professor Fitz to testify before the board on Thursday. So I don't know what Ashland County will do or can do. The tribes, are they going to use this as ammunition to get the feds to say, hey, you know, treaty rights say our safety is guaranteed by treaty rights. How this is going to be used and how GTAC will counter it, you know, remains to be seen, I guess. But it's a big player in this.
Now, have they commented on these findings yet? Because I think they previously said they didn't think there was asbestos in the rock.
They did say that. And then in August 13th, the DNR wrote a letter to GTAC and said, we need a lot more information from you. And one of the things was about asbestos and the potential of it being on the site and going in the air if they use explosives. And GTAC has not replied to the DNR from that August 13th letter, at least not as of late yesterday.
Now, we know that asbestos is a bad thing, but could you talk a little bit more about the public health concern that it might present? Should it, you know, get in there and get into people's systems?
Well, mesothelioma is the concern. There are a lot of cases on Minnesota's Iron Range. There's debate about if that's actually from the ore itself or if it's from asbestos, which was a common insulation and used in the 50s and 60s into the 70s. That still is part of the argument. But there, what can't be argued is there are a lot of cases of this kind of lung cancer on Minnesota's Iron Range. So the concern is, would that be a problem here? And the question is, can it be mitigated? Let's say that there is a lot of asbestos in this area, but can they, you know, contain it so it's not going to get into the air? And Professor Fitz doesn't think so. He thinks even something as simple as the bulk sampling will be dangerous. And the DNR says they don't think the bulk sampling would be dangerous. And from the bulk sampling, we'll find out if there's more asbestos in the other sites.
Now, you mentioned that it was found in this rock at a concentration of 60%. Seems like a pretty high number. Does that, as far as you know, does that represent an outlier in terms of what mining companies have found in rock before? Is this a high number that we should be, you know, people should be worried about?
Well, Tom Fitz is worried about it. And Tom Fitz says it's an extraordinarily dense figure. But again, this is where the DNR says, well, let's just wait and see. We need some more facts to come in. I talked again to Professor Fitz today, you know, and we really do need to find out what's in the other sites and if this is uncommon or common. That'll be a factor.
Now, can you give us a little bit of an update about the status of the proposed iron mine and the opposition?
It never seems like this thing's on hold, but because there's always something that's coming out of it. But really, it's on hold until the DNR makes a decision about whether or not to allow bulk sampling. And that's 2 or 3 months away. They can't do anything until the August 13th letter is answered. Then they have a month to fact find. And then they have a month, meaning the DNR, to make a decision. And then GTAC can go ahead and bulk sample or the project stops. Because if there's not bulk sampling, then it's all over with.
All right. Well, Mike, thank you so much for being here today and keeping us up to date.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me.
That was Mike Simonson, WPR's reporter up in Superior.
Coming up next, a look at how one Wisconsin company is spawning consulting firms all over the country with some high-paying jobs, too. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Look at Wisconsin business now. We'll talk about a booming Wisconsin industry, electronic healthcare software.
Epic Systems, a national leader in electronic health records, has experienced rapid growth in the past decade as hospitals around the country have begun implementing its programs.
This hasn't just meant success for the company, but also for consulting firms that have piggybacked on their growth. Our guest now wrote a piece about that and the impact that Epic is having on consulting here in Wisconsin and around the country. Kathleen Gallagher is a business reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Kathleen, thanks for joining us. Kathleen, are you there?
Hello?
Hi, Kathleen, are you there?
Hey, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yep, I sure can. So tell us, what kind of growth, before we get to the consulting businesses you wrote about, what kind of growth has Epic Software seen in the last decade or so?
Epic has had phenomenal growth. They were founded in 1979. They had revenue of about $1.5 billion with a B this year. It was 47 million with an M in 2000. They employ about 6,800 people, and their workforce has tripled since 2005.
And their gig, their main line of work, is software that healthcare providers use. Is that right?
Yeah, and you know, it really relates to the U.S. government is trying to get all these hospitals and clinics to use electronic medical records, and they are the leader in supplying electronic medical record systems.
And they're a big deal in employment in central Wisconsin of in and of themselves, right?
Yeah, you know, I've heard anecdotally from some of the people I talked to in Madison that there's been kind of this revitalization in downtown Madison, and many people attribute it to all the bright young people from Epic that are being hired there who want to live downtown and go to restaurants and that sort of thing.
And your piece mainly focused now on the spinoffs from Epic and this healthcare software. What are the consulting firms you're talking about?
Yeah, so what happens, I've used spinoff loosely. What happens is when Epic goes in to put a system in, you know, anyone who's gone to Aurora or Freighter and Children's in Milwaukee, I'm sure there are others around the state, when they put in one of these systems, you can imagine how much work it is to get everything onto a computer system. Well, the Epic people come in, and they'll have one or two Epic employees overseeing all this. They rely on the fact Epic's philosophy is, you know, we don't want to do this and then walk away and you don't know what you're doing. We want you to be engaged in this system because you're going to have to live with it. So Epic assumes that they're going to have some of their people and hire some consultants who can really help them get the whole thing working.
And then, hence the rise of these consulting businesses. Now, are we talking about a bunch of consulting businesses concentrated here in Wisconsin, or are they springing up all over the country to help healthcare providers in other states, too?
They're springing up all over the country. So there are several big ones, relatively, you know, reasonably sized ones in Madison, but all the big accounting firms now have an Epic practice. I even heard, I couldn't document this, but someone told me anecdotally that there's one hospital system that actually has an Epic consulting group within its system that goes out and helps other hospitals add these systems.
And how big a difference do you think this is making to our economy here in Wisconsin? Obviously, in the worlds of politics and business, there's a lot of focus on trying to get jobs, especially higher paying jobs in the state.
Epic has made a huge difference, just Epic alone, because, first of all, of the talent they're bringing in. You know, they hire a lot of liberal arts grads from the best universities in the country. You know, it's interesting that they're bringing in so many people and they're, you know, creating such a huge tax base in their ever-growing facility. They don't get much attention. The woman who founded Epic, Judy Faulkner, is someone who doesn't seek attention, and they've always been a relatively quiet company in terms of promoting themselves in the popular press and that sort of thing. So, you know, you watch from a vantage point like mine, and we're always talking about, you know, how are we going to grow the economy in the state, and rarely does Epic figure into that discussion, yet they're a huge part of the economic growth in the state.
Now, with these consultancies, could I just, assuming I had some relevant skills at all, go off and say, okay, hey, I'm putting up my shingle, I am now an Epic consultant, or does Epic have something to say about that?
You absolutely could not do that. Epic has a lot to say about it. Epic controls who can be a consultant. They are the only organization that certifies these consultants. Most of the consultants have either worked at Epic or they've worked in a hospital system. Because when you think about it, excuse me, not only do you have to understand these systems and the software, you have to understand the workflow at the hospital and what they do. So Epic has modules. You know, the module for the OBGYN function in a hospital is called Stork. Some of the names are very clever. And so you have to understand, you know, when a woman comes in, and she's pregnant, you know, what happens? You know, what kind of appointments does she have to have? Who does she have to see when she has the baby? You know, where does she have to go? Because think about, you know, any experience you've had in a clinic or hospital, you need to maybe get blood drawn. You know, your doctor needs to check certain things in your history, and all of that has to be integrated into these Epic systems.
Is there a sense that Epic and the Wisconsin-based consultants you're talking about are keeping, you mentioned bringing in some people from out of the state, is this keeping young professionals in Wisconsin who might otherwise go off, venture off to Chicago, New York, California?
Definitely. You know, the University of Wisconsin-Madison has one of the best computer science programs in the country, and historically, you know, it's been the stomping ground of Microsoft and Apple and Facebook and Google. You know, that's where they get a lot of their employees. And I think what's happening is, you know, Epic is one of the companies that helps to keep some of those people here. And then a lot of the people who come from out of state, they come, they like it. They work at Epic for 5 years. They leave Epic and they start a company or they get a job at a different company. So I think it's had a, particularly in Madison, it's had a huge impact on the state.
Now here in Wisconsin and around the country, I think state economic planners, city planners, you name it, have a dream of getting the equivalent of Silicon Valley in their area. I'm sure we're not there yet, but is there that sort of sense of a synergy of Epic and these consultancies and maybe other software firms getting this kind of self-perpetuating dynamic that's going to bring more businesses in?
Yeah, and I think it's been very organic. You know, it hasn't come out of any kind of central planning. It's been that, you know, because Epic has been so successful, they have attracted the kind of people who are people who do things like that, who start companies and who have innovative ideas and who understand IT systems and understand how to market them and how hospitals work. So there are other companies, too, that have, you know, that I think these people have started. I haven't investigated that fully, but I think there's probably more than just the consulting firms.
Now, I think you wrote that the stimulus back in 2009 helped spark the growth here. How important is that and how much does it hurt if and when that dries up?
You know, it's huge because it's what's driving all of these hospital systems and doctor's offices to adopt electronic medical records. You know, I talked to one guy about that, one consultant who kind of said, you know, that the downside is when this money dries up, I think it's in 2019, you know, Epic, there probably has to be kind of an Epic II system, right? That's maybe less expensive, fewer bells and whistles, whatever, you know, however they decide to address that from a business perspective. But I think in the big picture, Epic is the leader in the field. There's a publicly traded company called Cerner that's another leader, but Epic, I think, is ahead of them. So even as this changes and as the government money dries up, you're going to have all of these people, you're going to have all of this business that's happened. You know, it's a game changer, I think.
And is there a concern, and I think you wrote something about this, these consultant firms, they're all based on Epic. It's like if you're an auto supplier, auto parts maker, and you only make something for a particular type of Ford model. If that model goes out of favor, your business dries up fast. Are people worried about that, and how would they adjust?
You know, my sense is that a lot of these people who work as Epic consultants, they understand information technology and software. And, you know, you're ahead of the game if you understand that. In today's day and age, you can probably figure out other opportunities. And what we need here is, in any industry we're trying to develop, is a critical mass of experts in that industry. And, you know, Epic is helping us get it.
Outside of this healthcare information systems industry, do we have anything else like that in Wisconsin? There's a big push for agricultural biosciences, and we're going to become Tech Alley or Biotech Alley.
Well, the University of Wisconsin-Madison is one of the biggest research universities in the world, and a lot of their research is in biotech and life sciences. So there is that potential. I'm not, you know, it's not a great time for those kind of industries right now in terms of raising venture capital and stuff, although that will probably change. And there needs to be more expertise built around that. Governor Walker also has a big push for manufacturing right now. And I mean, from my perspective, it seems like that's the thing the state is most focused on, is manufacturing. in all forms.
All right, Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That was Kathleen Gallagher. She's a business reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We'll have a link to that on that article she wrote on the Central Time Facebook page. That's Central Time on WPR.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll get a fiscal breakdown from a member of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
Then we'll explore the prostate monologues, hear about one man's battle, his experiences, and his life with prostate cancer.
And then a poet shares her pilgrimage through her mother's Alzheimer's disease and share what she's learned over the years and through that experience.
That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Coming up after the news, a new Frontline documentary takes a look at the concussion crisis in the NFL. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Beginning in the 1990s, evidence began to surface from the scientific community that the kind of repeated head trauma experienced by football players could have serious mental health repercussions.
Since the early 2000s, news of erratic behavior, dementia, and even suicide among some of the sports stars has made its way into headlines around the country. While the NFL claims no guilt, settled concussion-related suits for $765 million this past August, the attention surrounding what some have called a crisis hasn't gone away.
A new Frontline documentary called League of Denial chronicles the expanding evidence that concussions and routine head trauma are dangerous to player health. It also details how the NFL has dealt with the evidence. League of Denial will air tonight on PBS stations from 8 to 10 o'clock. And we're joined now by Jim Gilmore. He is reporter and co-producer of that documentary. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Well, League of Denial opens with the story of Mike Webster of the Pittsburgh Steelers. He was an institution on that team for a lot of years, but I wonder if we could start by telling what happened after he left.
Yeah, I mean, Mike Webster, as probably everybody knows in Wisconsin, was a great football player, a very good father and family man, and renowned four-time Super Bowl player for the Pittsburgh Steelers. Tough guy, known as Iron Mike. And what happened after he retired is that his life went down very, very quickly. He was depressed. He was showed violence. He lost the ability to think straight. His wife told us that he just turned into a completely different man. And very quickly, he lost the ability to take care of his personal dealings. Economically, he lost all his money. his marriage fell apart. And he ended up oftentimes living in a car. His physical ailments were so intense that he couldn't sleep, and he would have friends tase him so that he could actually get some rest. Mm. His life fell apart very quickly, and at the age of 50, he died in 2002. And our story, to some extent, really begins after that, after he dies, because what happened was that he ended up with a pathologist who didn't understand why this had happened to this man. The pathologist was a Nigerian-born doctor, a very talented man who didn't know anything about football. But he saw a problem here, and he wanted an answer. And so what he did is he had the brain extracted from Mike's head, and slices were taken from it, and it were sent out to get stained so they could understand what was going on. Why had this man seemed to come down with a case that kind of looked like Alzheimer's disease at such an early age?
And what did they find?
They found a disease that had never been found in a football player before. It's called CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And it's very similar to the disease that affects boxers. who have got pounded around and have been in the ring too long and has taken one too many punches. And what it is it's tau protein, which is in the brain normally, but it sort of goes awry deep down within the brain and sort of from the bottom up. And when he saw this, and it took a while because they did lots of tests and he didn't really expect to find anything. But what he finally understood was that this was a very important point because this was caused by something, and he assumed what it was caused by was the continual pounding that Mike took when he played football for almost 20 years as the center on the Steelers, one of the hardest positions, a position where Mike used his head as a weapon, basically, and play after play after play after play, he would have his head pounded into the heads or the bodies of other football players. And over time, what Omalu figured out and others have followed up and believe is also true, this constant battering of the head has huge consequences. And the finding of CTE in Mike Webster really was the beginning of this story to some extent, even though concussions has been an issue that has been looked at really, as you said, the early 90s, late 80s, when a series of great quarterbacks had to retire early. And due to that, and due to some the pressure brought by the press and people like Lee Steinberg, who was an agent who eventually Hollywood fashioned Jerry Maguire after, who got worried about all his star quarterbacks. And he started pushing the NFL to do more, and they were having seminars and such, and eventually the NFL actually did set up a committee of doctors to look at the problem.
But spend some time in the film taking a look at what actually happens to the head when football players collide, and you have football players themselves talking about it. And it's interesting. Something happens when the documentary starts. You show clips of football and football players taking hits, and you're just watching football,
right,
like normal. But as you go deeper into the story, after a while you see these hits, and they start to feel incredibly painful to watch. Like you're seeing something a lot more damaging, you know, than what you appear to see on the surface as normal football. So I wonder how much damage, you know, was done to football players over the year, and how widespread is it? We know about Mike Webster and how severe his case is, but how common is this among football players?
Well, that's the question. That's the big question. Causation and prevalence are the two things that the NFL keeps saying that has never been proven, and that is one reason why the NFL over all these years has been able to sort of say we need more scientific research. There are no answers as of yet, and that's one of the things that's really looked at. But when you what we focus on is the work of a couple of pathologists, including Dr. Omalu, and then a group that in Boston that became very involved as of 2007. In this research, and because this disease can only be found after the death of a player, you have to take the brain, you have to slice it up into pieces, and then you have to stain it with certain chemicals to find this tau protein. Up until now, it's very difficult to evaluate it. Now, 46 NFL players, plus many, many other brains, have been evaluated in this way, and out of the 46 players that have been dissected, 45 of them have this disease of CTE.
So 45 of 46 players have showed evidence of CTE.
Right, and that's why the pathologists you'll see in the film tonight and the people that work with them have raised red flags about this issue, and their feeling is that the prevalence is much higher than one would expect. Now, what's going on in the scientific community is they're trying very hard, and a lot of people say that right over the horizon is the ability to find this disease in living people. Once that is possible, well, then everything changes, because if you can answer the question of prevalence, and if you can tie it directly to who has it and who doesn't have it, because one of the other issues is when do you get it? I mean, how many times, as you said, how many times do you have to get hit before it? Or things like taking steroids or alcohol use or genetics? Are there other elements to this that make certain people more able to have this disease? And to a large extent, that is a very hard question to answer.
Now, the NFL has cultivated the idea that football goes hand in hand with violence, that it's this blood sport, you know, for fun that we watch on TV, because
right.
I guess they think that that is what people want. Do you think that influences the players to make it more violent? Does it have to be as violent and as leading to these many concussions, do you think?
It's a combination of factors. And one of the things that players say to us and others that are involved with the sport is, the game is even more violent than one realizes, that the public realizes. When you stand on the sidelines of an NFL game, the size of the individuals playing, the speed that these athletes can get going to, the power of the hits that are equivalent to being in an automobile accident going about 25 miles per hour, and this is happening play after play after play, especially for the guys on the line, the violence is exceptional. What makes people, the guys that we talk to, the football players, I mean, these are brothers in arms, under arms, basically. They feel like they're going to war with each other. They have a feeling of a responsibility to each other. They're highly paid, and it's very, very competitive to be in this business, and so they don't want to admit when they're injured, if they are injured. And so, therefore, it's a combination of factors that make people play this game and play it to the violent level that it is, and also the public expects it to some extent. I mean, it is fascinating to watch, and it's part of the nature of the game. I think that probably is going to change, and it's already changing to some extent. The NFL is trying to make small adjustments to it so that it's a safer game and try to take the head out of the game. But it's a very difficult thing to do.
We're talking right now to Jim Gilmore, co-producer and reporter on the Frontline documentary League of Denial. And what about you? Have you or someone you know experienced trauma, maybe head trauma from playing football? And what about whether you're a parent? Do you let your children play football? And how do you feel about that decision? Does hearing about this repeated head trauma and the repercussions, does that make you pause for a moment? And what do you think about watching football? Is it morally sound to watch football, knowing what we do about how damaging it is to the player? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
We're picking up again with Jim Gilmore, co-producer and reporter on the Frontline documentary called League of Denial, about the concussion crisis in the NFL and the physical costs for NFL players.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this, what's being called a crisis in concussions in the NFL? Do you still watch the game, or does this put you off? Would you let your kids play tackle football? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Send an email, talk@WPR.org.
And Jim, part of the story is the NFL itself and its evolution and how it deals with the mounting evidence that these brain injuries are serious and lasting. And as you said before, they're widespread,
right,
based on how the NFL players' brains looked after death. So how have they responded over the years, and where are they now?
That's a sort of a main focus of the film. They seem to be in denial for a lot of those years. As far as when even Mike Webster's brain was discovered, what was happening there, that he had CTE. In 2005, Dr. Amalo put out a paper in a very good scientific journal, Neurology and Neurosurgery, and he defined it. He was backed up by several other very famous neuroscientists, and he defined exactly what they had found and what the ramifications of it were. And instead, his thoughts were that the NFL would be very interested in what he found, because this is such an integral point to understand about the playing football. And what happened instead was this board that they had set of doctors, the MTBI. The members of this board came after him and wanted the paper retracted and rejected his science, and in many ways throughout the years tried to discount everything that he found, because he found other individuals immediately afterwards that also had the same disease. So from that point, the MTBI has sort of a very interesting background. So started in 1994, about 2002 or so, they started putting out scientific papers. By 2007, they had put out 16 reports. And if you follow the science of what they said over these years, the common sort of point that they make over and over and over again is that there's no proof that concussions are dangerous, that they're taken care of correctly. There's no problem in one of the papers reports that if someone gets a concussion in a game, there's no problem in going back into that same game. The same paper says that though there is no research in high school students or college students, that it's possible that there would not be a problem for kids who get a concussion in a game to go back. There's this belief that the NFL player, for instance, is a superhuman being that somehow can will not be injured in the same way that other people will be injured. If you talk to many critics and a lot of scientists at this point, they look back at these reports and they just question why the science was so wrong. This at a time when other scientists and other doctors were writing reports that kept on finding these connections to much more depression in retired football players and potential suicides amongst this group. And then the CTE studies that were being slowly collected by pathologists in different parts of the country.
Now, we've got a lot of folks waiting to talk to you, but real quickly, what is the NFL saying today?
Well, I mean, the settlement, they still say there's no direct tie to CTE to football. They have admitted in the past that, yes, concussions can lead to long-term problems, but they said that like once, and then even now, the normal response from the NFL is there's not enough evidence of causation. There's not enough evidence mm-hmm. about the prevalence of the disease. More scientific research needs to be done. And in the film, one ESPN reporter that we talked to, Peter Keating, says, you know, they started studying this back in 1994. It's now 2013, and it seems that that's a long enough period of time where some answers should have been found over this period of time.
All right. Well, let's get to our callers. Deb is first in Lake Mills. Hi, Deb.
Hi. I just really have a comment, and I think it really is unfortunate that science didn't come to the fore. I have a young son who, between the ages, middle school age, sustained a succession of 3 concussions playing junior high school football, and developed, as far as his psychiatrist was concerned, an attention deficit disorder. And his physician recommended that he never play contact sports ever again.
So it sounds like the doctor ascribed the damage to the head injury.
Exactly. And I was wondering if, speaker has any information about young people who are, the game of football overall, and children are participating from the ages of 4 on up. And what recommendations he might have for parents with children who sustain concussions at young ages.
All right. Thank you so much for that question, Deb. And Jim, what would you say to Deb?
I think what Deb is bringing up is probably the most important question out of all of this, and one of the major reasons that I thought that this program was so important to do. We talked to one of the doctors involved that has been involved in this for a long period of time is a doctor by the name of Dr. Cantu, who's based out of Boston University, and he's involved with the group that is working with this Dr. McKee, who's a pathologist, and they have a brain bank that has been looking at this since 2007. And he's made some comments over time that he got him in a lot of trouble, but a lot of more people are agreeing with him as time goes by. And his attitude is that the a child's body is very different than an adult. And before the age of 14, the neck is not developed very well, and the anatomy is just, and the brain has more potential for damage if it's banged around a lot.
So don't let him play football.
He says don't let him play football. The pathologist, Dr. McKee, says the exact same thing. The pathologist, Omalu, says the exact same thing. Now, you know, NFL, I think, understands that this is a huge problem. And what they've been doing is they have a heads-up program where they're trying to, I think they've got 600,000 kids involved with it, where they're trying to teach people the basics of football again and not to use your head when you're tackling. That might be successful. It's certainly a positive thing. But the fear is that, you know, the human body is not made to get it banged, you know, back and forth between, you know, players on the field. It's just not built to do that. And science cannot tell you at this point whether, you know, one individual is more susceptible to it or another is. But one thing is very clear is the younger you are, the more potential damage there might be. And this is a huge problem.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call, Deb. And let's move to Mark in Wausau. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I only played football in high school, so I was already 14. And I know that, you know, as long as you're aware of what you're doing, we avoided a lot of the injuries. I really don't see where it's that big of a deal to play football, to be honest with you, because I think it's a great team-building sport, a lot of fun. And if you know what you're doing and you play right, you can avoid most of the accidents. And pretty much anything you do nowadays, somebody has the potential to get hurt. And I don't think football is any worse than riding a bicycle, say, where people fall off those all the time.
All right. Well, thank you, Mark. That's an interesting perspective. Maybe we just need to train players how to play safe. What do you think about that, Jim?
Well, I mean, you know, it's an important point because, and this always will come up in this debate because football is a great game, and there's no doubt about it that the team play is exceptionally important for kids to participate in, and there's so many benefits. Plus, the fact it's really fun to watch. It's really fun to do. So the question then becomes, well, then how do you deal with this? And I think slowly there has been change. This macho attitude of always playing even though hurt has to change. This idea that if you've got a concussion, you can go back in sooner rather than later. Multiple concussions is not a problem. There's a lot of things like that can change the rules of the game so that people cannot use their head as much, that run backs on kickoffs are shorter distances so the momentum of people coming in to do the tackles is less. There's all sorts of changes like that certainly would be useful to happen. Not having full contact practices, number one, is a huge thing, which the NFL already does. But I know in my town, the kids are out there in high school and stuff having full contact practices every night that they're out there. Why that hasn't changed as of yet is a big question.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there, Jim. But I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Listen, thank you very much.
All right, we've been talking to Jim Gilmore, co-producer and reporter on the Frontline documentary called League of Denial. And you can catch it on PBS stations tonight from 8 until 10 o'clock.
Next is the news. Then we'll continue our Geek Out series. Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss joins us to talk about a renaissance in board games. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.